Welcome back from the weekend, members. I will not call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I would like to get started. So if we could actually have the department come down, and we'll talk about some... Now we do have a quorum. Now we will call the meeting to order. Call the meeting of March 9th, Transportation Policy and Finance together, or to order, apologies. And Representative Anderson, have you had the chance to review the minutes of March 4th?
Just looking at them now, Mr. Chair, and I approve them. Motion to do so.
Representative Anderson moves the minutes of March 4th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Welcome, sir, to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Schottauer. I'm the director of the Office of Transit for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thanks for giving us an opportunity to tell you what we do in our office. I'll start by giving an overview of our office and then talk about the transit programs in our office, and then I'll introduce Tim Mitchell, our bicycle and pedestrian coordinator, who will follow up with our bike and ped programs. So our office is divided into three different sections: management services, program management, and the bike and pedestrian section. So I'll give a brief overview of each. Our management overview section is where the planning and accounting professionals of our office reside, as well as some people that work on some pretty technical specific programs. So that's where we do our planning and research for the transit part of our office. We manage federal grants, and that includes everything through the grant process, from writing grants, making payments, closing them out, reporting to the Federal Transit Administration about them. We do the financial administration for our office, our entire office, from this section. That includes our biennial budgeting, encumbrances, and payments. And then we have some specific technical programs. For example, our office works with the Department of Administration on a statewide bus procurement program that all the transit agencies in Minnesota can participate in, and they get a little bit better pricing that way. We also help the transit providers in greater Minnesota administer their drug and alcohol monitoring and testing programs. The transit program section of our office is really where the rubber meets the road. It's where all of the Greater Minnesota Public Transit operating and capital assistance grants are put together. We do contract management there all the way through the process. So we have an application every year where all the transit providers in Greater Minnesota apply online, where we will evaluate those applications, negotiate with each of the transit providers on their share of the funding that's available, do all of the amendments, reports. We also have the staff in that part of our office that oversees all the transit providers, and some of that office staff actually has their offices in our MnDOT district so that they're closer to the providers. And they help with audits and closeouts of each of the grants each year and start the process annually over again. We also are responsible for a lot of data management, where we're keeping track of all the operating statistics. We help with the facilities and capital management or asset management. And we also provide technical assistance, helping them plan their services. We also offer help with rideshare technology, like programs that help them dispatch through automated means to their bus drivers. And we help provide training and workshops for all transit providers across Greater Minnesota. Then you'll hear more about the bicycle pedestrian section from Tim Mitchell, the coordinator for MnDOT. But that's where they direct planning and research activities for bicycle and pedestrian. They also coordinate facility design training. So this is something that's provided for not only MnDOT's designers, but for local jurisdictional designers of roadways or other facilities, so that they know how to do bicycle and pedestrian facilities with them. They provide technical assistance across the state as well. Part of what we do is develop bikeways and U.S. bicycle routes, the first being the Mississippi River Trail that was signed, two-thirds of it so far, one-third to go. And they also administer MnDOT's Safe Routes to School program. Our office is responsible for the non-infrastructure grants, and MnDOT's Office of State Aid does the infrastructure grants. And finally, one thing that's not too well known outside of MnDOT is MnDOT owns three parking structures in downtown Minneapolis, the ABC ramps that are kind of located right around Target Field. So our office also is responsible for the management of that, and we work with the city of Minneapolis to manage those ramps as part of their overall municipal ramp system downtown. So let me quickly tell you about our biggest programs, our biggest grant programs, and the largest by far is the Public Transit Participation Program. That's the program that provides general fund money, motor vehicle sales tax, motor vehicle lease sales tax, and some federal funds to the greater Minnesota public transit providers. On the public transit side, we don't grant any money inside the seven-county metro area except to some rural parts with some federal money only. Our state statute requires us to only grant public transportation money to greater Minnesota. So in that public transportation program, we have three different federal programs that are parts of that. There's the small urban program, the rural transit formula program, and then bus and bus facilities program. And those are all formula programs in which money comes to the state of Minnesota from Federal Transit Administration. The small urban program money goes directly to the transit providers in the bigger urban cities in greater Minnesota, small urban by federal standards. So those are the cities like Rochester, St. Cloud, Duluth. There's seven in all. The rural transit money and the bus and bus facilities formula funds do come through MnDOT to be granted out to the greater Minnesota transit providers. Those funds are also combined then with the state funds that you see at the bottom of the list right now. So the general fund monies that come into MnDOT are distributed across greater Minnesota transit. Also the greater Minnesota transit account, which is made up of the motor vehicle sales tax and the leased motor vehicle sales tax, gets distributed through our office to the greater Minnesota transit providers. On occasion, we'll get fund appropriations that can be used for transit facilities in greater Minnesota, not for buses, and they can only be used for the transit providers that are public agencies. Then just going back up to the federal list for a minute to describe a few of the other programs that we support. One of those is public transportation on Indian reservations. There are federal funds that are granted directly to some tribes. There's six of them in greater Minnesota that receive them. And those tribes can also apply for state funds, or excuse me, not state funds. They can only apply for federal funds through the rural transit program that we manage as well. We also support the Enhanced Mobility for Seniors and Individuals with Disabilities program. That's something that we manage statewide. And we work closely with the Met Council on the grants that are done in the metro area for that program. It's about a $3 million program across the state with silos for the Twin City area, another silo for the small urban cities, and then another silo for the rural communities. And finally, we do a couple planning grants through our office. One is the Metropolitan Planning Grants that goes out to the cities of population of 50,000 or more for their metropolitan planning programs. And then we get some state planning money. All these are from Federal Transit Administration that we can use for our planning purposes. The public transit program has been fortunate to grow over the past several years where we've got most of the state covered now. This map illustrates transit providers by one colored sets of areas. So for example, on the northeast corner of the state, there's a large number of orange colored counties that are managed by the Arrowhead transit providers. There's only one county in greater Minnesota that has no transit at all, no public transit at all, and that's Waseca County. There are about four counties in which there is transit only in municipal or urban areas, and there's three counties that have just some partial coverage. But then all the rest of the counties have pretty good coverage, but that varies a lot from place to place. So I'm a little reluctant to say that it's countywide service because it might only go to part of the county on a rare occasion, like as little as once or twice a month if it's really sparse there. But it's at least some coverage. As I mentioned before, there's seven small urban systems, eight municipal systems, and then a total of 30 rural systems, of which 16 are multi-county and 14 are single county. The providers that we work with, that we grant funds to in order to give that transit service, have a variety of organizations. Some of them are transit authorities that are by state statute designated. That's Duluth and St. Cloud. Some of them are city governments. Some of them are county governments. Some are joint powers organizations. For example, Rainbow Rider is a joint powers organization that serves the counties of Douglas, Grant, Pope, Stevens, Todd, and Traverse counties. And then others are nonprofit organizations. A good example of that is the Arrowhead system that I mentioned earlier in northeast Minnesota that covers Aitken, Carlton, Cook, Itasca, Coochiching, Lake, Pine, and St. Louis counties. It's one of the biggest transit agencies in the country by area. And a lot of people think that the folks that ride transit in Greater Minnesota are just the disabled or the elderly, but that's just a small slice of what's out there. 33% of the people that ride Greater Minnesota Transit are going to work. I should mention that these figures are from the last time we did a Greater Minnesota Investment Plan, so these were taken in onboard surveys in 2010. But we learned that 33% of the people who ride it are going to work, 20% are going to school, and 50% of the people that use it 5 days a week, so they're regular commuters of some sort. And 86% ride at least twice a week. So that's for everybody across Greater Minnesota Transit. The statistics below the line are a little bit more specialized, where if you just look at the users in rural counties, 50% of them are over 65 years old. It's interesting that 76% of the senior riders are female, and 33% of the senior trips are for medical or basic shopping needs, which gives you an indication that they're also using transit quite a bit for their social opportunities. Ridership in Greater Minnesota Transit's been slowly climbing over the years, and it hit a high of just over $12 million for the years that we have total data on. We're just about there with the 2014 numbers as the transit providers finished their reporting, but 2013 hit over $12 million. And the way that they provide that, of course, is by the number of service hours that they can put buses on the street. So you can see that that, too, has been able to grow over the last 10 years for the most part. And that hit a high of about 1.15 million service hours on the streets in 2013. That'll be higher again in 2014. Some of our major emphasis areas that I'd like to describe are a program that we call Transit for Our Future. So that's an initiative that in which we encouraged Greater Minnesota Transit providers to really work together to improve service, efficiency, and management. And by working together, what I mean is that we're asking them to actually coordinate with their transit neighbor, cooperate with them, consolidate with them in cases where that makes sense. So just a couple examples of what we mean by some of those. For coordination, there are transit agencies that are neighboring up in the Bemidji area. Paul Bunyan Transit and Hubbard County Transit are working together, where Paul Bunyan's a little bigger and could afford to have a automated dispatching system. Well, Hubbard County contracts with Paul Bunyan in order to have Paul Bunyan run the dispatching for the both transit areas or both transit provider service areas, and that saves them both some money and makes them both work better. Another example of cooperation is a couple transit agencies that they knew that they needed to beef up on their ability to follow federal regulations. We throw a lot at them for expectations for that, and they ended up hiring a shared employee that helped them with their disadvantaged business enterprise and their drug and alcohol and a lot of the other regulation requirements that we throw at them. And then consolidation's been happening quite a bit. Just like you see small governments often sharing truck stations and those kind of facilities, transit agencies are finding that it's worthwhile for them to consolidate because they can share their administrative services. And plus, it often has a benefit for the riders in that by having adjacent transit providers consolidating, you can provide one trip across the entire two service areas where they're instead of the two trips that they might have had to take in the past. Another thing that we're working on is an update of our transit investment plan. As I mentioned earlier, we did it in 2010. It came out early 2011. And we're right now just starting to embark on an update to that. So that will align well with MnDOT's 50-year vision and MnDOT's statewide multimodal transportation plan. What we'll use it for is to set our expected levels of service in different sized communities across the state. We'll update our performance measures. We'll define goals and investment priorities and then develop some strategies that we will use to try to achieve those goals. And then one other thing I'll finally mention then is our annual transit report. It's chock full of data. It comes out right about this time each year. It's not quite out yet, but it should be in the next few days here. So in there you can find statewide transit information, not just Greater Minnesota, so metro area as well. It'll list how every transit agency in the state is running, who's the contact there, all sorts of financial and operational statistics for them. So with that, I will stop briefly and see if you have any questions.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somebody who knows transit out at the airport tells me that there are a lot of private services that leave the airport to go to various places in greater Minnesota. Have we made any effort to see how we might cooperate and align our services so that that whole system is perhaps more effective?
Mr. Shadower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have one of the things I didn't mention that's part of the rural transit program is the inner city bus program. That's a Federal Transit Administration program that aims to serve or to provide inner city service to rural communities, and it makes sure that people that live in communities of under 50,000 have access to the national bus or other transportation network. So each year, or sometimes every 2 years, it's not a required annual thing, we'll have a consultation with transit provider or inner city transportation providers across the state, and we develop a plan where we ask them to bid for grants for service areas that we think are lacking, and then we try to make sure that that fits in well with the kind of service providers that are out there providing the private services that Representative mentioned. So we do work with them in that way, but we're not in any way trying to organize where they go or that kind of thing. We're more reacting to where they go.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding the overview on page 2 regarding pedestrian bicycle section. It talks about ABC parking ramps and management. What I want to get at is we do get federal funding for a bike and ped section coordinator. I believe we get federal funds for that. That's not fund, that position that we fund for that does not do this ABC parking ramps, correct? Or does it? And if it does, why would that be a part of it?
Mr. Shadower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct that the person that works on the ABC ramps does not get any of the money from the Federal Highway Administration that's used for bicycle and pedestrian coordination. That position is funded completely on ramp revenues.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair, and so there's no management oversight of the ABC parking ramp that's being using federal funds for bike and pedestrian for that work?
Mr. Shadower.
There's certainly management for any position in MnDOT. You know, I'm managing the entire office. The pedestrian and bicycle coordinator is managing part of that person's time. That person also works on bicycle efforts as well, so it's not a full-time ABC ramp coordinator position. So the bicycle pedestrian coordinator signs that person's time sheets, makes sure that everything's taken care of as a supervisor would.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, so you're saying what percentage of time is dedicated to that out of that federal fund?
Shadower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, could you clarify what percentage of whose time?
Any of the federal funding that comes for bike and pedestrian section coordinator, is there any percentage of that time being used to manage ABC parking ramps?
Mr. Shadower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is probably a tiny bit of time that is, yes. I don't know a percentage, but I would estimate it to be below 5%.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Shadower, I'd like to build on Representative Hausman's question. Do you work with the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access? Is that part of your office, or Mr. Shadower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, our office staffs the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. My immediate supervisor, Tim Henkel, one of the division directors at MnDOT, is the chair of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. So, yes, we work very closely with that group.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've had some what I think are productive conversations with your staff about the idea of a website being used to share information for these multiple systems. And it actually came from a constituent who said, how do I get from Lake Crystal to Hibbing? You know, how do you figure that out? And there's some potential. Can you give us an update on that website? I understand that you're seeking a contract, and want to nudge that along a little bit. See, hoping it's making some progress.
Mr. Schottauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are actually a couple different websites that can help with that. One is the one that's managed by the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. So that has lots of information about coordination, but I think you're talking more about from a user perspective, how do you find where you can go? And there are a couple different websites that can help with that. One was developed as a result of a grant, a federal discretionary grant that MnDOT received from the Federal Transit Administration for Veterans Transportation and Community Living Initiative. And even though that's the title of it, you're not required to just do things that help veterans. You can do things that help veterans and more. So as part of that, MnDOT was able to work with the state area agencies on aging to develop a statewide one-call, one-click system that provides information for getting places. And it's not limited to veterans to call or use that site. So that would be a source for putting in or calling in and giving an origin and destination and being able to do what a lot of people do with Google or MapQuest, but in a transit world.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, I understand there's funding, though, to create a website to basically where I could type in Lake Crystal and I could put from Lake Crystal and type in dot Hibbing, and it would access information from the multiple systems, and I can imagine it's relatively complex, whereby I could get an itinerary to get to where I want to go. Is that, am I correct in that understanding?
Mr. Schottauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's certainly where we're trying to go with it. It's more complicated because some of the systems that you'd probably be riding on would be dial-a-ride systems where you would have to still call and make a reservation, but it would give you the information that you would need for the systems that you would want to use to make that trip. So it's trying to do that, but it's not quite to a here's an itinerary or when you get on and get off type thing.
Representative?
Thank you, and then I'll finish. Thank you very much. And I would just encourage that completing that because that I think that would be helpful. And I would also encourage the office to look at the airport as a central spot. I want to tell a quick story. A number of years ago, I used to teach in Mexico, so a couple of my former students from Mexico flew into Minneapolis, right? And they're going to come visit me in North Mankato. So what their reaction was, they went downtown to the bus station to get a bus to Mankato, only to find they had to go back to the airport to get Landa Air to come to Mankato. And they got a big kick out of that. Mexico has a tremendous, an amazing public bus system. That merits a look-see, I think. But my point, what got me thinking, I started realizing how many providers come in and out of that airport, and then the access of the airport to the light rail. There's some potential there. I just want to build on Representative Hausman's idea. I think there's some room to move there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schottauer, you mentioned on your last slide, you referred to the 50-year vision. Can you capture for us just quickly, what is the 50-year vision statement of the agency?
Mr. Schottauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 50-year vision is for MnDOT to help to enhance the health of people, the economy, and the environment. And the 50-year vision plan has way more details to it than that, but that's it in a nutshell, is that we're trying to put together transportation systems that work together to enhance people's, the environment's, and the economy's health.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Schottauer. It sounds like a vision that could encapsulate almost any activity. Mr. Schottauer, you mentioned general fund dollars with as you looked at the colorful map of Minnesota and the different regions, where in the general fund does the Greater Minnesota Transit get its funding from, and what are the approximate amounts biennially that you get from those?
Mr. Schottauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the general fund appropriation for Greater Minnesota Transit comes in the, it's listed with the other appropriations for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. In the current year, fiscal 2015, the general fund appropriation was $23 million. That was a $6.5 million increase over what was previously there because of a reduction in motor vehicle lease sales tax. And that was a decision last year's legislature made to kind of offset that change for the motor vehicle lease sales tax.
quickly,
yep,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shadower. Tell us more about the coordination within these counties. I've heard from my constituents that, you know, there's this transit system going on out there. Obviously, people are becoming dependent on this. That's what happens when we grow new pieces of government. And it looks like they've been growing all across the state. But I've been told that the transit systems are not even coordinating with the county boards in some cases, or with the disabled providers or the nursing home folks, who are, in at least in my mind, the two groups of folks that we got to provide transit for. What's happening with that? Is that what your office does? It seems to me there should be, the county board should know what's going on in their counties. Comment, if you would, on that.
Mr. Stadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you'll find that varies a bit from place to place in the state. In a lot of transit systems, the county board actually is the board for the transit system, too. And in others, they're less involved. Our office takes a role of encouraging coordination, and that's whether we're working just as our office as the grantor for these monies, or if we're working through the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access that was discussed before. We recognize that there's a lot of government-provided transportation out there, and the best way to get our bang for the buck out of it is to use them together. And sometimes they have different funding sources, different silos, different insurance requirements, but we're trying to fight through the barriers between those so that vehicles can be shared, that programs can work together rather than side by side, and get the best efficiencies possible. But yeah, there's varying levels of success or lack of success out there.
Thank you, Mr. Shadow. Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of an FYI, DART's Transportation in West St. Paul has a woman on staff that is, she has a federal grant for 2 years. This is the second year. And that's exactly what she is doing, is literally contacting every transit provider within the county. I think this year she's focusing on the businesses so that we can figure out how we can use our resources in a much more cohesive fashion. So you might want to be interested in having her talk about what she's doing sometime.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you. And to Representative Draskowski's line of comment and question here, and perhaps you can expound on this a little bit. And I will be having a bill before this committee, I think this week, on non-emergency medical transportation. That is some of what Representative Draskowski is talking about. We do have private providers who provide that. And one of the things that the committee may be interested in is in having MnDOT join our committee. Over the last couple of years, we found that Minnesota as a state does a woeful job of encouraging people to take public transportation, and instead have to come to rely on a phone call and a private provider coming to the door and picking them up and taking them to their stop. Other states do a much better job of getting people on public transportation, and we don't do that here in the state of Minnesota. So part of what I will be bringing in my bill, and perhaps you can, you know, comment on, I was looking on your slide, who rides Greater Minnesota Transit. One of the biggest controversies and discussion we've had is about Greater Minnesota, where there's less transit than in the metro area. But we are going to be in that piece of legislation encouraging the whole system to push people onto public transportation or the use of their own car or a volunteer driver or friend, which is very common in Greater Minnesota, and not rely on the private providers. And so on the slide on page 4 on who rides Greater Minnesota Transit, I don't know if we have an accurate number, but if 33% are going to work and 20% are going to school, I would guess part of the rest of that are taking their doctor appointment trips through and somehow being reimbursed or using it as part of their non-emergency medical transportation.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're very right. Our staff has been working with the folks at the Department of Human Services on non-emergency medical transportation and trying to find ways that can save the collective programs some money. And it's hard for both sides. One of the difficulties on the public transit side is that if everybody on the human services side gets to ride at the public transit fare, then they're not recovering enough costs to provide suddenly a ton of new service. And it's a lot to work through for everybody, but the idea is that if we've got this opportunity to have a more efficient system, and if we get all the money that's available for that system together and work together, we should be able to do it a lot better than we have so far. And we're trying to get there working together with the agencies involved.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, I mean, there are a number of proposals out there on this issue. I'm bringing the collective one from the committee forward, but one of the things we hope to do is, as we move people off a more expensive private system and put them on their own reimbursement or volunteer drivers or the public system, it will allow us to free up money for rate increases, which I know some of you that serve on other committees have heard this year, because the providers are unable to make ends meet on the current rates. And so we hope by pushing people who can use public transit onto public transit, we'll free up money for those in wheelchairs and who have other mental health and special needs that really do need a protected service. We'll have the money to be able to fund that. So thank you, and I'll look forward to having that hearing.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a figure on what the Greater Minnesota Transit present law receives annually?
Mr. Stauer.
Mr. Chair.
Is someone here?
Are we talking about the combined Minnesota Transit accounts, so the motor vehicle sales tax and the leased motor vehicle sales tax?
From wherever, Mr. Chairman, how much is the budget for Greater Minnesota Transit now?
Sure.
Current law.
Of state funds, the total is approximately $97 million in this fiscal year for Greater Minnesota Transit. So that's including the general fund and the motor vehicle sales tax and the leased motor vehicle sales tax.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, general fund and what?
Motor vehicle sales tax and the motor vehicle lease sales tax.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Stadauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Mitchell, the Bicycle and Pedestrian Coordinator, is next.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record and continue with our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Mitchell. And I supervise the bicycle and pedestrian section in the Office of Transit. And Mike alluded a little bit in terms of general terms what our group does. So what I wanted to do is just kind of highlight a little bit more some of the specific tests that are going on, and then also the Safe Routes to School program. A couple things that I do want to say before I start. In large part, the majority of what we do is trying to leverage existing resources and existing partnerships to try and bridge a lot of successful initiatives across the state. And that's with a lot of different statewide organizations or agencies, regional agencies, locals, all across the gamut. We are recognized as the second most bicycle-friendly state in the country, which I know our agency and all of our partners are very proud of. And in terms of walking, we're certainly trying to put more emphasis in those areas. The first initiative that I want to talk about is our statewide bicycle system plan. This has been underway for about a year and a half. As you'll see, it'll be done early this summer. A couple key things about this that I want to bring to your attention. We've spent a lot of time talking with the public and our partners about what they want to see out of this plan. And we've gotten some really fantastic public feedback from across the state in terms of a MnDOT effort. I would go so far as to say in record-breaking response. One thing that we did do with this is that we did recognize that a lot of the public outreach that we got were people that self-identify as bicyclists, and we wanted to ensure that we were getting to a broader reach. So MnDOT has an online community that's a representative sample of everybody across the state, and we actually opposed the questions that we had been asking people throughout the year to them, just to gauge whether or not the feedback that we were getting was consistent with what the larger population may be expecting of us. And it was almost a resounding reaffirmation of what we heard from people who self-identify as cyclists. So in general terms, what we've heard to this point are that people want us to focus on investments in their communities, where trunk highways can either serve as an opportunity or a barrier. They certainly prefer what we call low-stress environments, which would be bicycle facilities that are separated from traffic, so shared-use paths or what we were calling separated bicycle facilities. And that last bullet, in terms of identifying a state bicycle route system, which Mike had alluded to earlier, our first element of that system is the Mississippi River Trail, which I'll get to in a second. We're also underway with a statewide pedestrian plan. A couple things that I want to highlight with this effort are that, as you'll see, that is scheduled to be completed in early summer of 2016. It is just underway now. I would bring your attention to that first bullet. This is an interagency partnership with the Department of Health to do this plan, where we both agencies have dedicated staff to putting the plan together. So it won't just necessarily be a MnDOT plan, although it will serve MnDOT purposes, but it'll actually be a plan towards improving conditions for walking across the state. The last bullet, this is certainly a first for a DOT at this scale. The only other DOT that we know that has a pedestrian-specific plan like this is Hawaii, which obviously is at a much different scale than us. We also do a lot of safety and education work. Our primary vehicles for this are the Share the Road programs. We have both for walking and for bicycling. All the messages that we relay are based on crash information that the Department of Public Safety and our Office of Traffic and Safety in MnDOT have worked with us to confirm and validate. As you can see, the pedestrian program was created in 2012. The bicycle program was renovated in 2013. And these programs really are instituted in a way that are grassroots. And we work with a lot of different partners, including the Department of Public Safety and local law enforcement, to utilize them. As we mentioned a couple times, the Mississippi River Trails is the state's first bikeway. A couple things that I want to highlight related to this is first just the magnitude of this route. It is over 800 miles long. The key to this effort is that this is a continuous facility that uses existing roads and trails. We did not build anything in order to put this together. The signage will be completed this summer, so all 800 miles will, actually 1,600 miles because it's both ways, will be done. And for those of you that aren't familiar with this route, it begins at the headwaters of the Mississippi and goes to the Iowa border in Minnesota, but the route is a national route that continues all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And then also this is known as United States Bicycle Route 45, which is one element of a national system of routes that is endorsed by a number of national organizations. A couple other things that I just wanted to briefly touch on are we have underway a new edition of the state bicycle map that will be available either late May or early June. This will be the second iteration in its current form. We're currently in the middle of ending our second phase and going into our third phase of a statewide bicycle and pedestrian counting project, which is attempting to be able to quantify what the use actually is out on the system and be able to reliably predict what what we may be able to see in terms of use based on different kinds of investments. Mike had brought up one of our functions is to work with people in terms of providing advice and technical assistance on different designs. And at least the bicycle facility design manual is in the process of being updated, and we expect that that'll be done by the end of the year. And then we are in the middle of an economic impact of bicycling study, which is going to look at a number of different things in terms of what the economic impact of bicycling is to the state, and that's being done in partnership with the University of Minnesota. Really quick, on to the Safe Routes to School program. So just to kind of catch everybody up, the Safe Routes to School program was something that was begun in 2006 in the previous Federal Authorization Act. The state program was created in state statute in 2012 and was first funded in 2013. You can see a vision that was first coined this year through an effort that I'll touch on in a minute. And in terms of how we move the program forward, we actually have this 27-member steering committee that advises us, and this is a large cross-section of different organizations and agencies from across the state that are interested in this program. And again, we have a pretty distinct collaboration with the Department of Health and the administration of this program, specifically the statewide health improvement program. You can see in terms of the funding how much has been allocated over the years since the beginning and the reach. You'll notice that there are different kinds of investments that happen, the primary being infrastructure, which would be like sidewalks, trails, crossing improvements, signals, etc. But we also do fund a lot of planning and then also different encouragement and education activities. This is just a map of all of the funded non-infrastructure projects. So again, those are the different planning and encouragement and education activities across the state. And here's a map of the different infrastructure projects that we've been able to we'd have been able to fund. And to quickly wrap up, some of the statewide programs that we are currently engaged in. The first bullet is a safety curriculum that is delivered across the state to elementary age children. This is done in a lot of different venues. It could be through the course of physical education curriculums within the school day. It could be after school programs through a YMCA or through law enforcement. And is also something that the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota assists us with as well in terms of delivering. We have been, this past year, we have done several solicitations, which you see. We did just complete an infrastructure solicitation that will be finalized and announced in the next several weeks. These mini grants are something that are new to our program, which are small little grants that help to support kind of initiatives that are kind of starter type initiatives for schools and communities. The bicycle fleets, we awarded, I believe, four different bicycle fleets for education purposes across the state, and then I had referenced the planning before. Some of the other things we just did complete or are in the process of completing this 5-year strategic plan, which is going to identify how we are going to move forward with the program into the future. And then the statewide resource center is something that we're trying to put together that will be kind of a one-stop shop for anybody who's interested in the program and how to get started. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Could you let us know what is your budget and where does that actually come from? What buckets are we
So I'd have to get back to you with in terms of what the exact amount is. I want to say it's about $750,000 to $800,000 for salary and staff time. It's both state funds and federal funds. Some of it related to the Safe Routes to School program are some remaining federal allocations that we had from that previous federal authorization. We do have trunk highway money that helps to fund our staff, and then, as was referenced before, some federal funds.
Thank you.
Senator Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding, you know, MnDOT is responsible for people's civil rights and for environmental justice through federal executive orders and those sorts of things. What role does your office play in ensuring people, the transportation system, is upholding people's civil rights and promoting environmental justice in communities so that people can move about no matter what mode they choose safely?
Mr. Mitchell.
Chair, Representative Bernardi, we support the efforts of the agency as a whole in terms of making improvements and further strides in those areas. I think our specific charge are that the two modes of transportation that we're talking about here are probably the most accessible to folks of all different kinds of income ranges and ages. So to the extent that we can make those systems better, I think we're helping to achieve those goals.
Any other questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that last slide under solicitations, what would the bicycle fleets be?
Mr. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the fleets are kind of a collection of different bicycles that go to educators at specific sites so that they can do these the curriculum that's identified there in terms of training children how to properly operate their bicycles and, you know, teach them all the safe behaviors. And the reason why these are important are that in some communities, in some situations, not every child may have a bicycle to access. So in order to teach those that curriculum, it's important to have.
Senator Hausman.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so the solicitation is you would arrange for group purchase, and then those fleets would go somewhere? Would you give it to somebody? Or
Mr. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that is correct.
Any other questions from members? Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. Mitchell?
Correct.
Thank you for being with us today. You know, I've just been kind of very surprised, I guess, at the at what has been the indicated mission of the agency. Maybe I should have read that somewhere, but environmental justice and providing for economic growth and development and, you know, I just safety. What happened? How does encouraging more people to ride bicycles on roads contribute to increased public safety?
Mr. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joskowski. You know, not everything that we do is in terms of encouraging people to be on the roads. It's more of encouraging folks to have access to the different forms of transportation that they are wanting to choose. In terms of safety, you know, some of the things that we do know, both anecdotally and a little bit in the evidence that's out there, specifically nationally, is that the more people that participate, the safer the environments do get. To the extent that we can, you know, provide this opportunity as something that folks can see as accessible and convenient, there can be a lot of different benefits beyond just the safety aspect.
Senator Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Mitchell, I mean, the one slide you talk about the Mississippi River Trail, First State Bike Way and over 800 miles total using existing roads and trails. It seems to me that we are encouraging people to use existing roads to ride their bike. I mean, that's kind of what I gather from that. And I don't know. They seem to be incongruent missions or goals if we are going to provide transportation for cars and trucks and other vehicles, and then encouraging people, using taxpayer resources to encourage people to ride their bicycles along these. Last time I checked, the bike loses every time. And so, you know, that just doesn't seem to be a real safe endeavor for our agency to be going. But I don't know if you have any more comments, but indeed it does seem to me, you know, as you indicated, that we are attempting to encourage people to use these by putting together a bikeway. And so I guess I have more of a comment than a question, but if you have any thoughts around that, please respond.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Henkel, please join the committee and state your name for the record and continue with our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Tim Henkel. I am the director of the Modal Planning and Program Management Division at MnDOT. I'd like to note that Dan Crome is the director of the Passenger Rail Office. I will be presenting on the Passenger Rail Office status. Fortunately, he could not be with us today. If you do have detailed questions in the future, please reach out to Dan or myself for any additional information on state rail planning, in particular the Passenger Rail Office. What I'd like to do very quickly is to provide a very brief overview of the history of the Passenger Rail Office, talk about the accomplishments over the past few years, and then talk about the future priorities of passenger rail in the state. First, it's important to note that intercity passenger rail is defined as travel on the rail system for those medium and long trips. Think about the service provided by Amtrak today, or think about the true high speed that exists in some countries today, like the bullet train in Japan. Intercity passenger rail can operate at different speeds and does, from conventional rail, which is less than 80 miles per hour, to enhanced or incremental improvement of that conventional rail, 80 miles an hour to 110, all the way up to what we call true high-speed rail, 110 miles per hour or higher. In some cases, all the way up to 220 miles per hour. When you get to true high-speed, above 110 miles an hour, you are required to provide grade separations, and anything above 110 miles an hour requires an engine plant that is electrified to get to that true high speed. A brief history. Back in and starting in 2009, there was significant change on the state and federal level, in particular for investment in the passenger rail, intercity passenger rail system. And in response to the new support and direction, both on the funding side as well as the legislative side, Minnesota legislature modified MnDOT's commissioner's duties as well as the planning requirements and established an operating budget for appropriations to the department to carry out the commissioner's duties and those new planning requirements. The Minnesota legislature back in 2009 appropriated a biennial operating budget from general funds of $500,000 per year. With those funds, we created a new passenger rail office to institute the commissioner's duties. We also received at that point in time in 2009 an appropriation of general obligation bonds in the form of $26 million. And to be able to move forward and prioritize projects, we also established an intercity passenger rail forum of constituents that would advise the Commissioner of Transportation on implementation of the comprehensive statewide freight and passenger rail plan. In 2010, we did meet the requirement of the state legislature to establish the Minnesota Comprehensive Statewide Freight and Passenger Rail Plan, what I'll refer to from here on out as the State Rail Plan. That plan made a number of recommendations that have been carried out by the Passenger Rail Office and the Commissioner since the adoption of that plan. They included the development of a robust passenger rail system, along with the enhancement for connections and facility improvements within the Twin Cities metropolitan area. It also recommended high-speed service between the Twin Cities and Milwaukee and Chicago, as well as between the Twin Cities and Duluth, and also the Twin Cities and Rochester, Minnesota. It also called for enhancing conventional passenger rail service, which is up to 90 miles an hour in this case, for those locations that are listed there, including Twin Cities to St. Cloud, also Moorhead, Mankato, Eau Claire in Wisconsin, and between Minneapolis and St. Paul. It also laid out a clear philosophy for prioritization, which was to advance projects incrementally and simultaneously as demand warrants and as funding was identified. So there was not a rank order specified, rather incremental and opportunistic. That $26 million of general obligation bonds has been invested and has leveraged approximately $66 million of infrastructure development and construction between 2010 and today. That leveraged about $40 million in federal aid, and it invested in the construction of two Twin Cities rail hubs, including the St. Paul Union Depot and Target Field, as well as continued project development for four corridors consistent with the priorities of the state rail plan. This graphic represents the total $26 million of general obligation bond status by priority from the St. Paul Union Depot of nearly $10 million of investment, Target Field of a little over $5 million, and then the continued corridor development activities, including work on a second daily Amtrak train from Chicago to the Twin Cities, accounting for $25.7 million with a little bit, about $261,262,000 of unspent general obligations bonds. Moving forward, with those being the accomplishments with the bonding authority and the operating budget, the immediate passenger rail priorities as we work to complete and update the state rail plan are listed here, including the Twin Cities to Chicago high-speed rail work on the environmental process, the Tier 1 EIS, the second daily train between Chicago and the Twin Cities, the Northern Lights Express, preliminary engineering and NEPA process. That's the corridor from the Twin Cities to Duluth. Zip Rail, Tier 1 EIS, the connection of the Twin Cities to Rochester, Minnesota. Continued work at Target Station, planning for future passenger rail platforms with potential connections of the rail lines out of Chicago as well as Duluth, as well as planning for Phase 1 and Phase 2 corridors that are identified in the updated plan, and you'll see that in a minute, as well as the completion of the State Rail Plan update.
Excuse me, Mr. Hankel. We do have a question. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in regards to something that's been in the paper and been talked around a lot is the discussion around the Zip Rail between here and Rochester. If I understand your chart there, $2.17 million has spent already on that proposal and the planning. Are there? Do you know if there are additional dollars to be spent and appropriated for that process?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hinkle.
Representative, the figure of $2.1 million is the total of the general obligation bonds that has been appropriated to that particular project. That project will continue into the next calendar year. Those bonds have been authorized, and so that will complete the scoping decision document as well as the service report that's necessary as a contribution to that overall Tier 1 EIS. The $2.1 million does not account for the total cost that will be necessary to complete the Tier 1 EIS. At this point, beyond the general obligation bonds, there is no additional capital available for that purpose. In the past, we've pursued Tiger grants, as an example, to be able to acquire the additional capital that's necessary to continue that environmental process.
So, a follow-up. So, if I understand it, the 2.17 was appropriated for through bonds, and at this point, there is no additional funding available for further study. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is correct.
Thank you.
A follow-up on that. Mr. Hinkle, you said there are additional funds needed. Do you have an amount on that?
Mr. Chairman, the estimate is somewhere between $20 and $30 million to complete the environmental process as a whole. That would be the Tier 1 environmental impact process. Given the complexities of this particular corridor and the alternatives that are being evaluated, it could be as much as that.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us, so the Zip Rail proposal, I mean, we've been hearing speculation that it's a private developer that's looking at this. My understanding is that this was a public effort. Was this initiated as a public effort? And if so, could you characterize for us what that effort has been since then and what it is now?
Mr. Chairman,
Trinkle.
Representative, this has been approached as a public sector government project. It was required to do so as a part of receiving the general obligation bonds and the use of the appropriation. There have been discussions with private sector interests, a number of private sector interests that have come to the table, offering opportunities for private sector funding and change in terms of the governance structure that might be required to do so. All of those alternatives are being looked at currently, and yet nothing has changed in terms of the outlay or agreement to move forward to use these general obligation bonds as planned today and to complete the work that's allowed with those general obligation bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it ends up being a private development, will the EIS process then have to be restarted because it's a different envisioned project approach and responsibility than originally envisioned?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a great question. If we're approached and there is an interested party on the private sector side, at that point we would have to talk with the Federal Rail Administration as an example, as well as provide legal advice here in the state as to what that would require. I don't know today if that would require that we restart the process or not.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've ridden the fast train in France and the one that runs from Washington to New York. Can you give me an idea of those speeds? I don't know if there are any other high speed in the United States, but where do they, what you're looking at here, where does that rank in speed? Washington, you know, the one from Rochester to here and so forth. What are we talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the speeds that we're talking about for the zip line are proposed to be true high speed, providing for the speed of a maximum of around 220 miles per hour, requiring an alignment that allows for that, the grade separations that are required, and electrification that would allow for that speed. That's consistent with what you see in other countries, not in the U.S. That's consistent with what you would see on the bullet train in Japan and some of those that are provided in Europe. And so those are the examples. Those that are provided on the East Coast via Amtrak are conventional or enhanced conventional speeds, where they might be able to garner those speeds for a short distance, as another example.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hinkle. I have a question back to the slides on page 13 where you're looking at enhanced conventional passenger rail service to St. Cloud, Moorhead, Mankato, and Eau Claire. And then the second slide after that, I see project development for four corridors. Was there any project development for any of the four corridors of St. Cloud, Moorhead, Mankato, or Eau Claire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. No, there hasn't been any additional planning at this point in time. However, as we look at the draft 2015 plan, which I can talk about in a minute if time allows, it does call for continuing that planning, and that's what's being suggested here, as long as the appropriation exists for the planning funds necessary to do so, and hopefully some capital in the future that will allow us to begin to make some of the investments as well. But today we've stuck primarily to the Tier 1 corridors, the connection to Duluth, the connection to Chicago, the connection to Rochester, with minimal work on those other corridors.
Jim Johnson. Thank you. One quick follow-up on that. I did understand that Mankato is also a Tier 1, just making sure that I've got that right. And then the other thing is, I'm curious about the connection between passenger rail to St. Cloud and the commuter rail to St. Cloud. Just to go, be on record, I was one citizen in Minnesota who could not figure out why we didn't go all the way to St. Cloud with that years ago, and I'm sure there's a legislative history on that, but that defied logic to this gentleman.
Thank you.
Mr. Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. Do we know of any successful example of anywhere in the world that high-speed rail has been done without massive taxpayer subsidies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not aware of the funding mechanisms that have been used in Europe or other locations, so I can't directly answer that question. We can certainly get back to you on how those have been funded historically.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have some examples of some successful multimodal stations in Duluth and St. Cloud. And it always puzzled me why we didn't have something like that in Rochester. Is there a plan to do that you know of? And what's MnDOT's role in helping to plan and implement these, you know, multimodal bus, sometimes rail, but usually it's a connection between intercity bus and local bus and other modes of transportation in these central core cities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, the passenger rail office has a responsibility to work with communities on the terminals as well as the connections between those terminals. Historically, as I said in my remarks earlier, the passenger rail office has partnered with, for example, Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul in establishing the funding necessary to complete, along with other funding, the terminal in SPUD in St. Paul, as well as Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and others, Target Field, as an example. If there is a connection that can become a reality called Rochester, the passenger rail office would have a responsibility to work with that community and to work with the government agencies that are responsible for delivering that passenger rail line. Included in that analysis and work would be a look at that terminal or terminals that are necessary to provide that connection, no different than the service that we provided for St. Paul and Minneapolis for those two terminals.
Thank you.
Chair, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wanted to complete my presentation with a quick overview of what's happening with the update of the adopted 2010 plan. This is what we call the 2015 State Rail Plan Update. This is a plan that is required by federal law, and it requires in federal law now that plan be updated every 5 years. Since that plan was last adopted in 2010, we're required to update that plan in 2015, and we are doing so. The plan is being updated to consider a number of changes that have occurred. We're not just updating it because of the federal requirement. From the freight flow changes that we have all experienced in this state and in this nation, to a requirement that we look at and include in that plan as a basis for future federal funding, a comprehensive list of projects. The work that has gone on and is nearing completion is integrating all of the work that has been done by the Passenger Rail Office and the Freight Office of MnDOT, for that matter, to understand and further develop the various corridors, the Tier 1 corridors, and any planning that we've done, cost estimates that have been developed, etc., as well as to investigate new public and private business models so that we have all of the options available to us as we move forward, again, noting that the general funds obligation bonds that were general obligation bonds that were provided back in 2009 have terminated, other than what have been authorized and can be used to their full potential in the next year and a half or so. So what's new in the plan is, first, to be in compliance with the federal requirements. Second, to address new trends in freight traffic, including the bulk and crude travel, the agricultural products, coal and gas, and containerized shipments. To continue to promote safety, particularly grain and crude oil shipments. Also to review and update the priorities and project list that was included in the 2010 plan. To identify the potential streams of funding that might be available, as well as to investigate new funding methods. If you're curious, this slide gives you a quick snapshot of the federal requirements and how that plan must be laid out. But also does give us some specific requirements on the data side, the chapters that must be included, the report on public outreach, as well as future directions. This is the map that you can use to compare the 2010 to the proposed 2015 plan. The only significant change that you will see in this plan is the extension of the route to and through Albert Lea down into Iowa to connect Des Moines with a connection that did not exist in the original plan. Again, much work has been done on those that are color-coded in red. Those that are color-coded in blue are our future priorities, as well as the light blue being the Tier 2 areas where, as an example of the representative's question earlier, that we would hope to continue the planning activities that are necessary for connections to areas like Mankato and Wilmer, et cetera, which are also important connections in the system. For any that are interested, Mr. Chairman, in the details of each of those projects that is underway, we do have a website that is listed here where representatives can go and find the nth level of detail prescription of what's happening with each one of these projects. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks. I'd stand for any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There isn't any way that fare boxes are going to pay for these, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the only corridor that we've studied to date as a part of the state rail plan, as well as follow-up, that nears fare box coverage is the connection of Chicago to the Twin Cities. The others would require some kind of supplemental income to be able to operate and capital investment as well.
Thank you.
Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hinkle, working off of Representative Earhart's question, what percentage of operating subsidies is average among these that are being planned, or what is typical, or what's your default percent of taxpayer subsidy that you're using in your planning for operating costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I honestly don't have those figures with me. It can vary from 25% subsidy all the way up to, I think, 50 or 60% subsidy for the state rail plan, to see if he shakes his head yes or no. But we can confirm some of those figures for you so that you have the actual figures on fare box versus what might be required as a supplemental income.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hinkle, I would hope that the agency uses our experience and history in order to accurately set those. Hiawatha now, and I don't remember what color it is, Representative Ornstein.
That would be the blue line.
Blue line, thank you. Hiawatha now is at 56 or so percent. The North Star is above 80% taxpayer subsidy. So if we're talking anything south of 50, we're not being realistic as an agency. Thank you, Mr. Hinkle, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard Representative Johnson ask a question. If we connect St. Cloud Does it matter whether we talk about intercity passenger rail or commuter rail? In when we look at a line like that, is there a difference in how the federal government sees that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, there is a difference in how those are looked at. The analysis requirements and the funding sources for those improvements. So they do differ for commuter rail, which would be an extension of North Star versus the extension or connection through along the existing alignment to Grand Forks and North Dakota and beyond on the interstate intercity passenger rail system.
And Mr. Chair, you're saying that's we wouldn't even be using no, we would be using the same tracks. But you're saying we're not studying two things there, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, correct.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could, one more. Between Rochester and the Twin Cities, do all of our figures assume a stop or not a stop between Rochester?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the scoping decision process that is ongoing is looking at a number of alternatives and looking at different station configurations. Each varies by alternative, so a number of different alternatives are being looked at in terms of that accessibility to the system.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I just want to be clear on your comment about that follows up on Representative Drazkowski about all lines needing subsidy. And talking with the private investors, they are telling me that this would, well, A, if it's a private company that does this, the state would have no subsidy. And we're also hearing, and so you can clarify for me if that's correct, and we're also hearing that whether it was state or not, there has been at least preliminary conversation that line, that high-speed rail line, could also not require subsidy even if it were done publicly. So could you tell me, I know that's still in early planning.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the study is underway. That will help us to understand what the total operating costs will be and what those subsidies will be. So it's not fair for me to comment without having accurate figures in front of me for the study that's ongoing to literally answer your question. My preference would be that we get the figures that have been developed so we can provide the facts to you on the Rochester line and other lines as well.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And so I'm going to ask for clarification again. The comment you made before that none of the lines are able to provide without subsidy, are you talking about the proposed lines that were not finished studying, or are you talking about the ones that have been complete? And second question is, if it is privately funded, the government will not be subsidizing it.
Mr. Engel.
Mr. Chairman, I think it requires that I collect the data and distribute the data to make sure that my comments are correct. What I stated was, it was my understanding and all of the studies that have been looked at to date, that I know that Chicago to the Twin Cities was close to being covered by Farebox. I just don't know what the answer is for Rochester or others, and I don't know what the private sector answer would be without looking at that in more detail.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to leave this because I know how things get twisted sometimes when we leave a committee if things aren't clarified. And I will just tell you, in my talks in the last several weeks with the private investors, they have said if they move ahead with this and it is privately funded, that there would be no state subsidy, that it would be privately funded by private industry. So I just want to be clear on that we don't take this information and use it differently outside this hearing room.
And we look forward to that discussion. Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You might ask them for an example that they've done which is going to prove that up. I think that would be a very tasty morsel to hear from them. Thank you.
Mr. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair. One of the things that hasn't been done, and we've talked about in this committee, whether it be bus routes or rail routes, is that there is a way to do it cost neutral. And it has to do with how much you charge. And so a private entity or a public entity could make all of these routes cost neutral by charging an arm and a leg for some routes that we don't want to charge an arm and a leg because we want it to be an amenity. But there is a way to do it cost neutral.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Just since we're on this topic here, it seems that we always, whenever something related to transit comes up, we talk about subsidy. And it's just a reminder that, you know, our road and bridge program is also subsidized. And so you're going to have this, you know, across modes. And I do feel that whether it's roads, bridges, or public transit, this is an essential role for government to play. So it's a little bit of a slippery slope when we start talking about privatization of these things, although I am curious to hear more about this development with the zip line as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Hinkle, since we're on this discussion, your site, or the MnDOT site on the 2010 plan shows the total system capital investment by 2030 would be $6.2 to $9.5 billion, but then it does show possible subsidy of that of $41 to $95 million. Is that changed significantly, or are those numbers fairly accurate?
Mr. Chairman, the draft 2015 plan holds fairly true the cost estimates that were derived back in 2010 for both the capital cost for both freight and passenger rail. That's a combined figure that you're looking at, and the operating costs that are associated with that. We're currently looking at somewhere between $6 and $8 billion on the capital side, and I'd have to look at the figures for operating. But expect that if you're looking at the draft plan, that those are fairly consistent and haven't changed a whole lot.
Thank you. Members, Representative Whalen, we have a couple more questions, then we need to move on to hearing a couple of bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I just was contemplating this idea of cost neutrality, and I think this would be a question for you, Mr. Hingle. I am thinking to myself, if we really wanted to be cost neutral and you were to charge an arm and a leg for fare, you're eventually going to lose you're going to lose a ton of ridership. So I'm thinking there, it may be the case that you wouldn't even get to be cost neutral because you would have to charge $100,000, and who's going to pay that? You know, when you're looking at the economics of it. So I don't know if you have any comments or thoughts on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I appreciate your comments. That's exactly the factors that have to be considered as we move into the planning process and into the preliminary engineering to be able to understand total capital costs, real capital costs, and what we're seeing in terms of the various ridership opportunities from different alternatives. It's only through that next level of detail that we can understand exactly where it's feasible and where it isn't, and what those calculations will be.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only have a comment, and I really don't even need a follow-up with this. I'm a pilot. I don't know. I don't get the attraction to rail. You know, I'd rather go 8 miles a minute than, you know, maybe 1 to 2, possibly 3 with this high speed. I could base a couple of Gulf Streams in downtown St. Paul and still beach it to Chicago, to Duluth, to Rochester, to Fargo. I'm an air guy. And if we could do it with subsidies, fine. If we can do it revenue neutral, fine. But I'll still beat you there. You just can't beat the air travel. So we're, but for us to even having this discussion for rail, to me it's a head scratcher. Because the air, we don't have the infrastructure. We don't have to beef up the rail lines. We don't have to beef up the rail crossing lines. It's a whole different avenue. So, again, it's just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And thank you, Mr. Hinkle, and Mr. Mitchell and Stadthauer for being here today with the committee. We appreciate your presentation. And now we will, Representative Howe, please come to the testifier's table. I will move House File 558, and we will be laying this over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically what this bill does is it's a response to having cities and developers not put the sidewalks in that should be there in the first place. And so what happens is these political subdivisions come now to request a grant to put those sidewalks in. And I don't have a problem with that, with older developments that never put the sidewalks in. But I believe that somewhere along the line, we need to draw a line and say, as an indication to cities, and to, if you want to be considered for a Safe Routes to School grant, you need to put it in your subdivision that these developers need to put in the sidewalks in the first place. Otherwise, what we could have is a developer builds a development without sidewalks, and the very next year they come in for a Safe Routes to School grant to come back and put the sidewalks in at state expense. I firmly believe that this would then require this those developers then to put that. I think we need to require the cities to put those sidewalks in, and instead of the state coming in and put them in. So I don't mind fixing the ones that currently exist back there. I just don't want any new ones getting fixed by state dollars, if that makes sense. So it's a pretty simple bill.
All right. Members, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howell, good idea. We say require a developer. You know, oftentimes cities will be putting in the sidewalks too. I mean, when I was mayor, we would frequently do that. Sometimes we would stick a developer if we could to get trails or sidewalks, but oftentimes the city would provide sidewalks too. The net result would be the same. We'd have the Safe Routes to School and we'd have the sidewalks done when a development's going in. Would that be your intention?
Mr. Chair, my intention is when we have these new subdevelopments going in, these new developments going in, is that they have it in their ordinance, their zoning ordinance, that requires those developers to put it in. And if they have that in their subdivision ordinance, they are good to go as far as a grant goes or an application to the Safe Routes to Schools grant. This, is, to me, would just be a criteria on the Safe Routes to Schools grant that says, do you have this, do you require that in your subdivision ordinance? And if it is, they can apply for the Safe Routes to School grant.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
All right, there you go.
And that could be possible, but again, you know, driving up the cost of housing and everything else, because of course the developer is going to add on that for the housing and everything else. And there are certain areas, of course, where you have to make connections, or in a plat where it's more appropriate for the city to provide the sidewalks. I mean, one way or another, we have to get the sidewalks in there, but I don't think we should specifically exclude cities or other local units of government to provide that either.
Mr. Chair, this wouldn't preclude that from happening. This just says you have to have it in your subdivision ordinance that you, when you do a subdivision, it requires the developer to put them in. It wouldn't require it. This would not preclude the city from putting them in. This just says that if a developer comes in with a plat, they need to figure out that requirement needs to be in the subdivision ordinance that the developer needs to put them in. Otherwise, I don't believe that a developer doesn't have to put it in, and then the city decides that they want to put a sidewalk in and comes from the entire state to put the sidewalk in. I disagree with that concept.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate what you're trying to do, because I agree. I don't want folks getting around this by not putting in sidewalks and then coming to the state and say, we're going to get the state to pay for our sidewalk. However, I would say there might be another way to do it, and that other way might be that if a subdivision is developed after a date certain, that they would not be if they do not have it at the time they're put in, that they would not be eligible for any Safe Routes to School, which would then allow, because I know there are some subdivisions in my area, particularly in the townships, that are and out in those areas that are, the homes are quite far apart, and I don't think they would want, or it would even maybe be appropriate for sidewalks in those areas. However, the rest of, then the whole city or area would be punished in a township. I don't see township in here, but in a town that would have those types of subdivisions, you don't want the whole city punished and other streets in that city who might be older, have older city, you know, housing stock. My street, for instance, doesn't have curbing even. You wouldn't want to hurt them. So I'm just saying, I agree with your concept. I think it's right on, and we should do something, but there might be a different way that wouldn't that would protect those older cities who may want the Safe Routes to School grants for something that's already there in their community in a different part of town. If that makes sense. I hope I'm making sense.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that. If we need to put an amendment to this that says after this enactment in 2015, I'm good with that. But I do agree that that's what we're trying to do, is not punish anything from yesterday, but to go forward from here on out, that you need to have that in your subdivision ordinance, otherwise we got issues.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that, because I do think there might be a better way to work it that will address some of the concerns you're hearing here, and so if you want help moving ahead, if I'm not making myself clear, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Howe, you know, I struggle with providing more mandates for local units of government, and wouldn't it just be easier to end the program? We could use the money for roads and bridges.
Well, and my comment to that, Representative Drazkowski, is that's probably a technique. It's probably not the preferred method. So I believe that I frustrated, because I lived on a street. My first house I built was on a street that didn't have sidewalks, and the kids played in the street. Bad scenario. I don't care which side of the road, the street you put the sidewalk on, but I'm a big believer. I don't know how this complete streets process works, but I do believe providing some sidewalks or trails to get to and from without having to walk in the middle of the street or on the side of the street, without walking on the street, I think is appropriate.
Representative Mason.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Howe. First of all, I like the idea that you're trying to, what the concept is, and I definitely approve of that. And having been on a city council, I can tell you, having to put in sidewalks after the fact is not something that you want to go through more than once.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, Representative Powell. Oh, excuse me, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My city is one of those that's pretty well fully developed, but not having sidewalks in a lot of the areas. Isn't some of this money come from Fed grants as well, federal grants? And how are you going to shut that money off if you can't tell the federals not to allow grants and so forth from the money that they're supplying, I don't think. How do we do that?
Somehow.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I'm not a Safe Routes to Schools expert by any stretch of the imagination, nor do I care to want to be, but I do believe that those grants are appropriated and managed by the Department of Transportation, and they are the folks that take that money and distribute it out, and if we have a process that we decide who gets grants and who gets that money and who doesn't, I think this should be part of the criteria in determining who gets that money and who doesn't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that if the federal money is here and you shut it off and say you can't use it, my city can't use it because the state's passed a law saying that even though every one of our cities should be equal, and I think we'd be in court. But that's all, just a thought.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I believe that you said that your city is all pretty much built out.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't apply to you, because this applies to new subdivisions.
Well, my point, Mr. Chairman, is we have a lot of areas that don't have sidewalks.
Mr. Chair, so this wouldn't apply to you because you're redeveloping. You're not. You'd be putting in sidewalks after the fact. This would apply to those new subdivisions. If you're going to come in and redevelop something, you've got a new plat, that's where this would apply.
Okay. Well, thank you, members. I think at this point in time, Representative Howe, we will lay over your House File 558, and I think if members have had some good points and suggestions, then I would suggest working with Representative Howe and either bring that back or work with it once it's in the bill. Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you.
Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 797 for possible inclusion.
Representative Sundin moves House File 797, and we will lay this over and for possible inclusion of the bill at a later date. Representative Sundin, two-year bill. Excuse me, prior to your starting, we do have a fiscal note, and our fiscal staff would like to make one comment there.
Mr. Chair, members, just a correction. We do have a revenue note. As I said earlier, the Department of Revenue does not prepare revenue notes until the bill has a hearing in taxes. However, this bill's companion in the Senate did get a hearing in taxes, so we do have the revenue note from that. And I will just note, unfortunately, at the time of the committee, the fiscal note was not prepared, but it is largely identical to the revenue note in terms of the cost to the trunk highway or the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, the Transit Assistance Fund, the General Fund. But I will note there is one extra expense in the preliminary fiscal note of about $170,000 cost to the Department of Revenue to administer this change.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was asked to carry this by Senator Hahn and introduce it in the House for consideration. There's two parts to the bill, Subdivision 1, Subdivision 2. Subdivision 1 is 5% of the bill. Subdivision 2 is the other 95% that really brings about that fiscal impact. I'd really like to dwell on my favorite part of the bill. It's the 5% that pertains to used goods. And there's a few points I'd like to make on that. When we're reselling used goods such as items in Goodwill, Salvation Army, that type of thing, some of those items are exempt, some are not. You know, the furniture, that type of thing, there are certainly added taxes to that, and it adds to the burden for people that are basically in need of utilizing the used commodities or used items there. So I think an exemption would be beneficial to those that can least afford to pay these taxes. So, on top of that, this bill could actually initiate some more domestic recycling businesses. If there's equipment out there that's going to be resold for, let's say, logging equipment or small businesses, these repair businesses could benefit by recycling some of these. Equipment items, and this is actually a reality. There's a move to utilize wood fiber up in the northern part of the state, and for a couple different purposes, direct energy uses and cogeneration units in Hibbing, Virginia, and in Cloquet Mill. There's a cogeneration unit that provides 95% energy independence within that mill. The more energy self-sufficient we can, the more energy self-sufficiency that our industries can generate and realize that to be a benefit for the whole state. That said, there's plenty of good reasons to give these industries and people that can least afford to pay the taxes a little bit of a break. On that, so as far as the rest of the bill, the expensive part of the bill, I fully expect that this committee would roll it up and hit me on the nose with it. So, rather than stick my neck in the Hornstein hangman's noose, let's. I just again ask that this be laid over for consideration.
Members, any questions for Representative Sundin? I was going to ask you to comment if you had any comments on the revenue note or the fiscal note, but I think you did make that comment, so I'll pass on asking for comments. Any questions for members? Representative Uglum.
Representative Sundin, with regard to the motor vehicles, so if I wanted to get this tax exemption and I wanted to buy a new BMW like Anderson wants, or a new Corvette, or whatever. And so, if the
if the dealer took it around the block, put a few miles on it, and then called it used, would this be an exemption then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uglem, I believe not, because I actually bought a car about a month ago, and it was a demo, and it was 3,600 miles on it, and it was originally delivered in April of 2014, and they were able to sell it to me as a new car. So, and as a matter of fact, the last 6 out of 7 vehicles that I bought were new cars, you know, when I was younger and didn't have the means to do so, I had to buy used cars and pay taxes time and time again whenever that car was sold. So, thanks for the question.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Oh, brother. I feel like I'm dealing with Swiss cheese here. The issue that was just brought up is one hole in the bill, but I also just, and I mentioned this to Representative Sundin as we were talking earlier, used goods is a very huge general category, and the idea that only poverty-stricken folks buy used goods is not true. And I wondered about issues such as antique dealers and some others, which could be very high-end and very expensive, but are indeed used. So I wish you luck in your rolling this in for possible inclusion and how you might address all those little holes in the Swiss cheese here, but I think I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Sundin, I will move House File 797 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we have a few announcements here. Apparently, we do have something affecting our website, our House website, so all the information on the bills of calendar have disappeared, and that's affecting all websites and all committees. So we're hoping to resolve that soon, but we did have our meeting posted and information for Wednesday on there. We will be meeting Wednesday in the basement. We have 7 bills up. We did add a meeting on Thursday after the floor session, and I would assume approximately around 4:30 in room 200. We have several bills up there again. We'll probably go from approximately 4:30 to 8 o'clock. And then finally, all legislators received an invitation to the Convention Center's auto show, and just letting everyone here know that that's from 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday at the Convention Center. It's the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. So I said that would pass that along. So with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.